In the Hollywood division alone, police had reports of more than a dozen unsolved murders of gay men in 1980. To bring a halt to the crime spree, Theis did something that had never been done before by the Los Angeles Police Department. He worked with the gay community to catch a serial killer.
The community is being victimized, so they've certainly got an interest in helping out.
That's him, he shouted to detectives.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Russia withholds orphans from trans-friendly countries, Uzbekistan's government drafts its own no-promo-homo law, and a gay bar serial killer unites cops and queers. Those stories and more this week, now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Elena Botkin-Levy.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 16th, 2024. Russian orphans will not be finding new homes in countries that support gender transitioning. State Duma Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin sponsored the bill in the lower house of parliament, where its final reading was approved. He wrote on the Telegram messaging app, "It is extremely important to eliminate possible dangers in the form of gender reassignment that adopted children may face in these countries." Volodin named at least 15 countries where those so-called dangers exist for adopted Russian children, including Australia, Argentina, Canada, and many European nations. Adoptions by U.S. citizens were halted after the negligent death of a Russian child in 2013. Russia banned adoptions by same-gender couples anywhere the same year. Another measure advanced in the State Duma would add childless propaganda to the ban on LGBT propaganda. As the birth rate tumbles and more than 100,000 Russian soldiers die in Ukraine, the bill prohibits the distribution of any material that dissuades couples from having children. Same-gender parents and other non-traditional families are also not to be depicted. Fines for media outlets that violate the restrictions run up to 5 million rubles. That's about 50,000 U.S. dollars. The adoption ban and the censorship of childless propaganda both passed on November 12th. They now go to the parliament's upper house, the Federation Council. President Vladimir Putin's signature can be presumed, since a bill would not pass parliament if he did not already approve. Duma Speaker Volodin defended the enactment of both bills by writing on Telegram, "It is necessary to do everything so that new generations of our citizens grow up oriented toward traditional family values."
Russian style, no promo homo, may be coming to Uzbekistan. The ruling National Revival Party's government announced late this week that it's drafting a measure to outlaw the discussion of LGBTQ subject matter. Russia's original ban also inspired similar legislation in Bulgaria, Georgia, and Hungary. Some of these laws prohibit talking about LGBTQ people in public schools. Others censor the topic more generally in public life. Mali Tiklanish Party leader Alashir Kadyrov pointed to a post allegedly by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka. In it, she reportedly claimed that her father would end federal funding to public schools that promote inappropriate sexual content and transgender ideology. Kadyrov wrote on Telegram, "We are working on adopting a law prohibiting any kind of propaganda in this regard." He did not give any specifics about the legislation. Uzbekistan is a socially conservative, predominantly Muslim Central Asian nation that already punishes gay male sex with up to 3 years in prison.
Transgender students would not be able to go to the appropriate bathroom at school in the U.S. state of Ohio under a bill approved by the Republican-dominated state legislature. It allows access to sex-segregated school facilities based only on birth certificate gender. The Protect All Students Act states, "A school shall designate each student restroom, locker room, changing room, or shower room that is accessible by multiple students at the same time, whether located in a school building or located in a facility used by the school for a school-sponsored activity, for the exclusive use by students of the male biological sex only, or by students of the female biological sex only. Intersex school students or staff are not covered. The bill won approval in the state Senate on November 13th by a strict party line vote of 24-7. The Ohio Center for Christian Virtue called it a huge victory for children and families. Republican Governor Mike DeWine has yet to announce if he will sign the bill into law. He has previously expressed support for the concept. His office is reportedly conducting a legal review of the measure. About a dozen other states have similar so-called bathroom bills, including Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Utah. Like Ohio, those states voted Republican in the recent presidential election.
Iconic lesbian feminist writer Dorothy Allison has died at the age of 75 at her Northern California home. The multicultural lesbian literary and arts journal, Sinister Wisdom, reported the cause of death was cancer. Allison published prose and poetry in journals and other books during her lengthy literary career. She was born in 1949 in Greenville, South Carolina, to a 15-year-old mother. Sinister Wisdom described her childhood as difficult, marked by poverty and sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. Allison is perhaps best known for her multi-award-winning semi-autobiographical novel, Bastard Out of Carolina. She talked about its genesis in an early 1990s interview.
Bastard Out of Carolina was the first novel that I published, and it took me 10 years to finish writing it. I started it in a series of short stories, and it surprised me when it became a national bestseller and a finalist for the National Book Awards. Truthfully, what I really wanted to do in that novel was essentially two things. I wanted to tell a true story about family violence and incest, true in the sense that it was totally real and accurate to my lived experience, and took people deep inside something they didn't want to know about. And the other thing I wanted to do was put on the page a memorial to the family that I loved, a huge, violent, working class family that had problems with liquor and poverty and generally being thought poorly of.
Dorothy Allison's wife, Alex Lehman, died in 2022. Allison is survived by her son, Wolf, and many friends.
Finally, out queer contingents are going to be part of the Staten Island St. Patrick's Day Parade for the first time in 60 years. LGBTQ groups fighting for inclusion had failed to get intractable longtime Richmond County St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee President Larry Cummings to change his mind. He told the Irish Voice in 2018 that the St. Patrick's Day Parade is not a political or sexual identification parade. However, the gavel officially passed to Edward Patterson on October 30th, and credit goes to him for the committee's change of heart. The Pride Center of Staten Island is now formally invited to march in the next parade on March 5th, 2025. Other queer groups will also be welcomed. The Pride Center's executive director, Carol Bullock, has battled Cummings for years. Her acceptance beamed, "This event is a time-honored tradition that brings people together from all walks of life to celebrate Irish culture, and we are excited to be part of this vibrant community celebration." The ban on LGBTQ people in New York's better-known St. Patrick's Day Parade in Manhattan was lifted in 2014. The parade in the Bronx allowed queers to march under their own banners for the first time in 2022. This year's official non-inclusive Staten Island procession was followed 2 weeks later by the Staten Island Business Outreach Center's alternative Forest Avenue St. Patrick's Day Parade that welcomed queer delegations and their employees. The new committee's decision was personal for Camila Hanks, a Democratic City Council member who represents Staten Island's North Shore. She told a news conference that her half-Irish transgender stepdaughter will be able to participate in the celebration for the first time. In her words, inclusion matters.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending November 16th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Elena Botkin-Levy. Stay healthy.
And I'm Marcos Najera. Stay safe.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you just see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? And ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? When I'm gone to Carolina, in my mind.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Village gay bars were terrorized by the bag murders of the late 1970s. The story convinced director William Friedkin to adapt a mystery novel by Gerald Walker into the highly controversial 1980 movie Cruising. A year later, another serial killer was preying on gay men. That story is just as fascinating and scary as told by This Way Out's David Hunt.
Go back in time with me. It's Saturday, February 14th, 1981, Valentine's Day, a holiday celebrating courtship and romantic love in countries around the world. In Los Angeles, California, police working the Hollywood division are overwhelmed with cases. Crime is soaring throughout the city, with robberies and murders up more than 25% in the past year. But LA is also in the midst of a budget crunch, and there are 300 fewer cops on the job. Hollywood's overworked investigators ask colleagues in the elite robbery homicide division to handle a case that needs a closer look. An unidentified man has been found, robbed and beaten into a coma on a residential street. Detective Mike Thies, who took over the case, remembers those days like they were yesterday.
During that time, it was kind of interesting. City of L.A., the county of L.A., we had several serial murders going at the same time. We had the Hillside Strangler and the Night Stalker, the Skid Row Stabber. It was just crazy. It was just some real crazy times, and our murder rate was just skyrocketed.
Thies didn't know it when he started working the case, but he was on the trail of another serial killer in Los Angeles. This one frequented gay bars and expressed interest in hooking up with other men. The gay men who thought they were leaving the bar for a one-night stand ended up beaten and robbed, or worse. To bring a halt to the crime spree, Thies did something that had never been done before by the Los Angeles Police Department. He worked with the gay community to catch a serial killer. I'm David Hunt. In a two-part feature beginning this week, I'm returning to a story I first covered as a radio reporter in the early 1980s. This week, you'll hear more of my interview with the retired detective who led a dramatic manhunt, forging an unlikely alliance of cops and queers to crack the case. Next week, I'll talk with the queer niece of one of the victims, who's striving to learn more about the life and times of a relative who died before she was even born. After 2 years in the Army at the height of the Vietnam War, Mike Thies came home to Los Angeles in 1968 to a different kind of battle. He returned to his job as a patrol officer with the LAPD at a time when crime was rapidly accelerating, fueled by the rise of street gangs and illicit drug use. By 1981, the year the major crime rate peaked in Los Angeles County, Thies was an experienced detective with the Robbery Homicide Division. The assault and robbery case he took over from the Hollywood Division on Valentine's Day, 1981, seemed routine for the time. The victim was in a coma and couldn't provide details of his attack. The man's wallet and ID were missing, so Thies didn't even know his name or where he lived. What he did know was that the man, later identified as 28-year-old Ernesto Ramirez, a local hairstylist, had been found after midnight, unconscious, lying on the curb of a residential street in Hollywood. His skull, face, and right ear were badly injured, and he was covered with blood. Thies got his first break in the case a week later, when the victim's friends reported him missing. Luckily, one friend, Mario Aguirre, had seen Ramirez leaving a West Hollywood gay bar, the Rusty Nail, with another man on the night he was assaulted. On February 20th, Aguirre sat down with a police artist to create a composite drawing of the suspect. Unsatisfied with the result, he asked to be hypnotized to enhance his memory. As a result, the drawing was slightly modified. Meanwhile, Thies got down to business.
After I got the case, of course, Ernesto was in a hospital. He remained in a coma for, I guess, almost 2 months before he died. But I talked to Aguirre and the other people, his friends. And then I just started looking into other cases for similarities, and it just started developing from there.
Thies reasoned that if the assailant targeted one gay man at one gay bar, he may have targeted other gay men at other gay bars. And so he called detectives in the Sheriff's Department and other LAPD divisions throughout Los Angeles to see if they had unsolved cases involving violent crimes against gays. In the Hollywood Division alone, police had reports of more than a dozen unsolved murders of gay men in 1980. After poring over copies of crime reports for hours, this was years before the LAPD's records were computerized, Thies found what he was looking for. A pattern. Here are the cases he began to connect. On July 11th, 1980, Michael Thomas, a 32-year-old West Hollywood florist, had been found bloodied and beaten on a local street. He died of head trauma a few hours later. Friends told detectives that Thomas was last seen at a popular West Hollywood leather bar, The Spike, just after midnight. An autopsy showed that Thomas had been struck on the head at least four times with a heavy, blunt object. On November 29, 1980, Robert Sanderson, the 36-year-old owner of a Burbank hair salon, had been found by a security guard on a West Hollywood street at 1:30 in the morning, staggering and covered with blood. Sanderson remained conscious just long enough to give his name and say that he'd been attacked. A friend told detectives Sanderson was last seen at a gay bar, the Rusty Nail, just two blocks from the Spike. Sanderson died in the hospital on February 12, 1981, of head trauma. An autopsy showed that he'd been struck on the head with a heavy object. On January 24, 1981, the body of Danny Harmon, a 22-year-old Kentucky man who'd moved to Los Angeles just weeks earlier, had been found in a Compton, California park south of Los Angeles. A friend told detectives that Harmon was last seen at a gay bar, Woody's Hyperion, in the Silver Lake District of Los Angeles. An autopsy showed that Harmon had been beaten with a heavy, blunt object and had died of head trauma. On February 21, 1981, 28-year-old Douglas Allison had been found on a Hollywood street at 1:30 in the morning, bloodied and gasping for breath. According to a police report, Allison had sustained multiple facial fractures, including fractures to both his upper and lower jaw bones. A surgeon who treated him stated that the injuries were caused by blows of substantial force with a smooth and probably heavy blunt object. Allison survived the attack but remained in a coma for 2 months. Friends told detectives that he'd visited several gay bars on the evening before his attack, including the Spike and the Rusty Nail. With the passing of Ernesto Ramirez on April 20, 1981, the death toll stood at 4. Thies knew he needed the help of the gay community if he had any chance of stopping the carnage. There was only one problem. Cops and queers in L.A. were divided into warring camps back then. You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. At a May 1980 hearing in front of the City Council's Public Safety Committee, dozens of angry gays and lesbians confronted three LAPD division commanders, demanding an end to police harassment of gay bars and their patrons. The owner of one gay club, Circus Disco, said repeated police raids had effectively shut down his club, but resulted in no prosecutions. Four city council members sharply criticized the police for devoting too much attention to gay bars and not enough to serious crime. One suggested that the council could trim the LAPD's budget even more unless the department changed its priorities. In a newscast for Pacifica Radio, I reported that gays and lesbians felt squeezed between two oppressors, gay bashers on one side, police on the other.
It is not just criminals who terrorize gays and lesbians. Raids of gay businesses and homes by vice officers and even the FBI are facts of life in many parts of the country.
Despite the bad blood, Thies realized that there was one very good reason for the gay community to put the past behind and work with his investigation.
Yeah, well, there, mutual interest. Their community is being victimized, so they've certainly got an interest in helping out.
Detectives, assisted by Ernesto Ramirez's friends, began circulating copies of the composite drawing of the suspected killer to gay bars throughout the city. They hoped someone could match a name to the face. Mario Aguirre, the friend who had seen Ramirez leave the Rusty Nail with the killer, went a step further. He agreed to take part in a stakeout of the Rusty Nail in hopes that the killer would return, looking for his next victim. On Friday, February 27, 1981, Aguirre joined two detectives at a restaurant across the street from the bar, while backup undercover officers cruised the surrounding streets. After nearly 3 hours waiting and watching, Aguirre and the detectives decided to go inside the bar, on the off chance that the killer had used the back entrance. Still, they knew running into the killer was a long shot. As they waited for a traffic signal to change so they could cross Santa Monica Boulevard, Aguirre looked to his right and saw a man crossing the street toward him. A familiar man. "That's him," he shouted to detectives. I'd like to say the search for the killer of four gay men in Los Angeles concluded with the arrest of a 40-year-old welder, Donald Miller, outside the Rusty Nail in West Hollywood on February 27, 1981. The truth is, the easy part of the investigation was over. The lead detective, Mike Thies, would soon find that keeping Miller behind bars and building an airtight case against the suspect would put him at odds with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office and ultimately the California Supreme Court. The high-tech tools of modern police work were limited in those days.
We didn't have DNA. We didn't have computerized fingerprints. We didn't have all the surveillance cameras that are so prevalent today. So it was a challenge.
Simply put, the case against Miller was largely circumstantial. He was seen leaving the Rusty Nail with Ernesto Ramirez. He drove the type of sports car that witnesses had seen in the vicinity of the assaults on Michael Thomas and Robert Sanderson. He lived near Woody's Hyperion, the bar where Danny Harmon was last seen alive, and he grew up less than a mile from the park in Compton, where Harmon's lifeless body was found. The key piece of evidence, though still circumstantial, was found inside Miller's 280Z, parked across the street from the Rusty Nail. It was a piece of metal pipe stored behind one of the car's bucket seats. For Thies, discovering the heavy metal pipe confirmed his suspicions. He knew he had his killer.
You know, it's a steam pipe from the railroad. You know, he was a welder, and these pipes, I mean, you had to be a fairly strong guy to even wield them, and Miller was a big guy.
But when Thies presented the case to the DA's office, prosecutors rejected it, citing insufficient evidence.
You know, they, especially since they found out about the hypnosis, they figured that Aguirre's identification was not going to be admissible. So that's part of the reason for the rejection.
The LAPD's star witness, Mario Aguirre, had undergone hypnosis to help enhance his memory of the man he'd seen leaving the Rusty Nail with Ernesto Ramirez. Prosecutors were well aware that the California Supreme Court was hearing a challenge to the use of testimony aided by hypnosis. To make the case, Thies would need more evidence or additional witnesses. 4 days later, Donald Miller was released from police custody. Unwilling to give up on the case, Thies ordered plainclothes cops to put Miller under surveillance. If he tried to kill again, the LAPD would be watching. Tune in to This Way Out next week when we continue this two-part feature tracing the efforts of an unlikely alliance of cops and queers to catch a serial killer in Los Angeles in 1981. I'd like to thank retired homicide detective Mike Thies for sharing his memories of the case for this feature. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
I've come this far without a cause. There's a price to be paid. And winter sings a violent song.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Elena Botkin-Levy and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Rachel Berenger, The Birds, James Blunt, Michael Witt, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Steve Sims of Seattle, Washington, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 8CCC Alice Springs, Australian Northern Territory, KEOS College Station, Texas, WTND Macomb, Illinois, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.